Hey there, it's Jonathan Capehart, and welcome to Cape Up. Actor Jesse Williams lit up social media with his acceptance speech at the BET Awards last year. And so on this episode, you're going to hear more of his cultural criticism and the reason he co-created a new app that puts black expression center stage.
So much of everything we consume is centered around whiteness, and then maybe they'll have to fill a quota and splash in some so-called diversity.
Oh, there's so much more, including us reminiscing about that time we partied in the White House with Naomi Campbell. No, for real. And you can hear it all right now. Jesse Williams, it is fantastic to have you on the podcast. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I'd seen snippets of your BET speech from last year.
Yeah.
But I'll admit that I hadn't watched it in its entirety until I was preparing for this.
How dare you,
sir? I know. I'm bad. I'm bad. I'm a black,
wow.
Bad black man. But listen, that speech was so powerful, so beyond on point, and so eloquent. Did you have that already planned? Because you were speaking from the heart. There was
yeah.
No teleprompter, and yet you gave this incredible sort of diagnosis of what the country had been going through up until that point. I believe this was November or December
June,
of 2016.
This was July, end of June, something like that, yeah.
And so where did all that come from?
Well, it came from our lives, right? It came from lived experience. But, I did have some bullet points drawn out. I, as I've said before, I was off shooting a movie at the time, really engrossing this really, like, up traumatized character who was a homeless war veteran who was a drug addict who had been living in squalor. And so I was spiritually kind of tucked away in this place, living alone in a hotel in Atlanta
wow.
for months, kind of, you know, not method, but really living in a dark place. And I got a day off to fly to L.A. from Atlanta, do the show, and then fly right back.
Hmm.
So this was my little window. So I didn't have much prep time because I had to be focused on I like to do one job at a time whenever possible and give my all and then move on to something else rather than being spread too thin. And so on the flight, I did jot down a bunch of notes and thought, kind of bullet points of things I think and know and feel like I want to touch on, depending on the vibe of the room. What I will also say is I kept in mind that I was at a creative arts award show, right? It wasn't the Peabody's. It wasn't something that, you know, it's on theme. So I wanted to be creative in the way that the syntax of the way I was communicating and have kind of a little bit of rhyme and rhythm to it for it to connect. And it was an artful space, and I wanted to, you know, have a little bit of a prose in there as well. So, but I was feeling the vibe of the folks. I was, you know, just kind of riding the wave.
So at the conclusion of, and I'm not going to do it any justice, but I need to read.
Yeah,
read
please
this.
Just do the whole speech. I want to hear a reading.
This will not happen. But here's a reading of the last bit that you said. We've been floating this country on credit for centuries, yo, and we're done watching and waiting while this invention called whiteness uses and abuses us, burying black people out of sight and out of mind while extracting our culture, our dollars, our entertainment like oil, black gold, ghettoizing and demeaning our creations, then stealing them, gentrifying our genius, and then trying us on like costumes before discarding our bodies like rinds of strange fruit. The thing is, though, that just because we're magic doesn't mean we're not real. And if you have not seen Jesse Williams' speech in its entirety, it is 4 minutes and 33 seconds of pure gold and pure genius. And I bring that up because once I watched the speech and reading the words as you were saying them, it put into greater context your latest project. And that's Ebroji.
Yeah.
You're wearing the hat right now.
Yeah. I see where you're going. I like that. Yeah, it does. It does offer. I mean, everything has to be rooted in some kind of, have some historical footing and be part of a larger narrative and be contextualized. And for the advent of Ebroji, which lives right now as I consider it like a cultural language extension tool, a GIF keyboard, GIF, G-I-F, keyboard that is highly curated around what's often considered Black language, Black expression, Black terminology, phraseology, which is to say American phraseology. And yes, that is our founders, myself included, just kind of were looking at the landscape of what's happening in tech, what's happening in social media, what's happening on all these forms of short form communication online, the kind of the evolution, the cyclical nature of language, mm-hmm. That we kind of started from pictographs and hieroglyphs and got into more elaborate prose and long form and the structures of the way we communicate. And then it's circling right back down to short form again, and LOL and emoticons and then emojis
OMG.
And GIFs and mm-hmm. all these acronyms. We're getting back to shorter, faster, more efficient, but also more expressive. And what we were looking to do is figure out two things. How can Black culture, cool culture, young, brown, non-white culture stay included in the way we express ourselves without having their culture and their forms of expression be pilfered and then sold right back to them later as a form of validation? The way we talk is often ghettoized and made something that we should be embarrassed about. It's slang. It's not proper English. But then it gets put in Webster's Dictionary and becomes the way. Now it's ubiquitous to call jewelry bling.
Right, I was about to say,
but you're
an
making
example
fun of
you've,
us.
You've used yeah. in the past is bling. It's in the dictionary.
Yeah, off the hook. Anything. Uh-huh. Like now it's on SportsCenter, said by white men, and it's okay. And, you know, that's fine. Language is a process. Dialect is culture. Language is political inherently. And culture is expressed through language. And we wanted to figure out ways to embrace that instead of run from it, and also allow ourselves to be able to speak simply while also not shedding the complexity of language. There are many ways for me to say what. I could say mm-hmm. that 14 different ways. There's a reason there's so many ways to say snow for Inuits, right? Because mm-hmm. embrace that. You don't have to shed that and lop your arms off to just say it the way corporate America decides is okay.
You know, you said recently, if I remember right, and I got this wrong, I think, you were talking about how companies, corporations mm-hmm. are always chasing cool.
Yeah.
And I think you say, but we are cool.
Yeah. What I was saying is what we see so often is pop culture and corporate advertisers, things that are corporations that are looking to market to people and tap into the zeitgeist, tap into what's cool. That's normal. That's always been the case. That's what their job is. I don't begrudge them that. But in doing that, those entities, their job is to chase cool, find out what are the kids talking about, what's hip, how can we replicate that or somehow embody that in our product so they feel they can relate to it and buy it and attach themselves to that culture. That's the way that goes. But we are cool. We don't have to chase cool. Young Black expressions, trends, fashion, dances, terminology is cool. We talk the way you talk. Because everybody's going to copy you anyway. Mm-hmm. That's my philosophy on that. So we're so often have to kind of wait for it to be filtered through an Old Navy ad that's going to sell me jeans and say they're on fleek. Now it's okay to say on fleek. When is it okay for me to wear my hair in cornrows? When a white girl does it who's on a reality show or something, and now it's okay, and we have to change the way what we call it. And there's a new thing that's funny coming out where like Tim's, Timberland boots,
yeah.
are now like the new fashion thing that's okay. You won't let us in your store because we're wearing Tim's. There are rules.
I totally forgot about that.
No Tim's allowed in the club, which means no blacks.
Mm-hmm.
No Heineken. We don't serve Hennessy. No hats. Finding all the uniforms to block entry, to create barriers of entry for black people. Until it's decided that, they have do-rags on high fashion runways 2 seasons ago.
I mean,
you wouldn't
what?
Let me in your establishment for that. So whiteness is a magic balm, right? It's a salve for so much. Just keeping those things in mind when we talk about the way we express ourselves, both physically, aesthetically, and also with language.
You know, you also said, and I couldn't write it down fast enough, you said something like, and maybe you'll remember, like, language is political,
mm-hmm.
And then there's the second half.
Well, there's kind of this triad in kind of our philosophy at Abroji, which is that language is political, that culture is language, right? And that culture influences politics. When we think about a whole range of things that I focus my time and energy on, a lot of that is on the ground work around policy and legislation that's working with Advancement Project.
On the board, right?
I am on the mm-hmm. board, yeah, as well as I'm also on the board of Sankofa, Harry Belafonte's organization, which combines art and activism. And when we think about whether it's actual police accountability or housing discrimination or voter ID, any of these larger issues, it matters because it's policy that's often designed in an anti-black manner that actually hurts people. As Stokely Carmichael said, if a white man wants to lynch me, that's his problem. But if he has the power to lynch me, that's my problem. Mm. So when we think about race and the way the political core nature of language and cultural expression, it's not about feelings. It's about, does it actually discriminate and hurt my chances to live my best life? But it's not just because it makes somebody feel bad. That's hard to measure and certainly hard to kind of regulate. What we're more concerned with is, are you banning the way I express myself? You know, what I always find to be interesting, for so long, black women's hair, so many black women's hairstyles that are illegal, unprofessional. You can't wear them in corporate America.
Mm-hmm.
And those are really just hairstyles that white people can't do. That's where the line is. Cornrows, dreads, plaits, different kinds of braids. It's just things that they can't normally do. Why is that? That's interesting. So I feel that that extends to language and the way we express ourselves. It's okay to say bling once when it's said on The Tonight Show.
Right. Well, you've actually said black language is ghettoized until it's appropriated.
Exactly. Now, if you put it in a different vessel, it becomes, the only difference is the color of the skin from the person that's saying it.
Hmm. You know, you're talking about black language that's ghettoized until it's appropriated. I remember the first time I started seeing On Fleek just sort of appearing from, I don't know, who is this? What's going on? And then I see, I think it was a Vine or something before Vine went away. And seeing this young black woman talking about her nails are done, her eyebrows are on fleek. And I'm sitting there trying to think, okay, I see how this is funny, but how does this become like magic? It's viral to the point where I'm watching an episode of Scandal, the show that comes on right after yours. And in the plot line, you have the candidate for president of the United States being videoed by his campaign staffers saying, you know, hey, is this on fleek?
Right.
It's like, right. Oh, no.
And what's the funny line of like what is and isn't cultural appropriation? And it becomes delicate and touchy for some people, but it's not about, it's about having equity, just like we're talking about policy or anything else. It's about just being equitable in the way we allow folks to live. And if what's good for the goose has got to be good for the gander. If it makes me less than, it makes me unqualified or disqualifies me for social promotion or promotion at my job or to be taken seriously because I talk a certain way or wear my hair a certain way, then does that apply to all of us or does white skin absolve me of that rigorous kind of level of judgment? So it's fine for us. We all talk like each other and want to be cool, and we're all going to, as we get older, going to be less cool. We're all going to be corny dads and moms and people that are embarrassing our kids. That's the way that goes. That's not specific to a culture, but it is about, that's about kind of detachment and distance from what is that core cool. And that doesn't allow us to, demean in the process. I think we have to embrace some of that.
So we have to talk about this app. And I have it open in front of me
your
right now.
So
and,
dope.
And there are listings for all the GIFs that you, and I am so happy to finally know how to pronounce GIF.
It's GIF.
GIFs. GIF. I mispronounced it.
Now it is a battle going on. Okay. There's a war being waged around the pronunciation of this. I acknowledge that. I say it's GIF because the G stands for graphic.
Okay.
Now, that seems like the argument's over, right?
Right.
But apparently the gentleman who created the GIF pronounces it GIF.
Uh-oh.
I have that sticks in my craw, Jonathan. I call it GIF because it stands for graphics, and it just sounds better. And GIF is a peanut butter.
Okay.
So anyway, the GIFs on a broji, and we have these really cool curated categories that are really tied to what's happening in culture now. So you're scrolling through the app now.
I'm scrolling through, and really, this is how I think when I'm trying to come up with, because I am an old man, but who loves to put in a GIF or
a splash
or
of color
or
something fun to contextualize what you're saying.
And so one is angry, not amused, bad and bougie, badass, concerned, scared, eye roll.
While you're texting your friends, while you're on a group chat, while you're on Twitter, you're communicating and you want to add a splash, you know, oof, I don't know about that. Mm-hmm. So you might go to side eye, you might go to not amused and have a whole bounty of GIFs at your disposal.
Yeah. I mean, I love these because, oh, and there's, a, of course, yes, yeah. And slay. I mean,
so these are things that are designed for us to use the way we ought to meet you where you are, which is mm-hmm. what so many, I think, communities' products are try to do is meet your consumers where they are, as opposed to having us constantly conform to somebody else's platform that wasn't really built for us, mm-hmm. and we swag it out for them and discover the cool. We get in that cave and we mine the gold and show you right. where the gold is. Instead of we just put a reflection on your own gold mm-hmm. and then let you come right to it.
And the other thing that actually, I don't know why it surprised me, but I'm thinking that I'm just going to see,
exactly.
since it's geared towards African, it's taking African-American culture and expression and putting it out there, that I was only going to see African-Americans.
Exactly.
And that is not the case
all. There's probably more white people in a faces in a Broji than other. The thing is, what we're just doing is we're centering it. So much of everything we consume is centered around whiteness, and then maybe they'll have to fill a quota and splash in some so-called diversity and inclusion. We are just—it's starting from a perspective, a different perspective, a black perspective. We're going to include ourselves. I'll tell you, so my vision, my personal philosophy on this so-called diversity, Jonathan, this word that we use as this kind of burden, this thing, we got to have a diversity initiative. We're going to have to hire somebody who looks like Jonathan Capehart to teach us how to not be racist and to make sure to interview two extra people. And it's this extra additive thing. And that's not how I view diversity. I view diversity as you're already doing the extra work. Just stop excluding us. Take away a step. Don't add a step. Stop the process of exclusion. Then you got your diversity. It goes. That's a different path. So I don't view the process of kind of including different faces as something that has to be more work. I think it's in fact less work.
But I mean, you spent a lot of time in the early weeks and months of this curating.
Oh yeah,
gifts and stickers and
very
all sorts of things.
Consuming.
What's the process that you use? Because sometimes some things that we see, particularly when it's an African-American who's, doing something, an interview that goes viral, like
sure.
Antoine Dotson,
yeah.
It's at once amusing but also super uncomfortable.
You've got to be careful. You've got to be careful. And that's part of our general philosophy is we're here to celebrate the most effective and best of our communication forms, not to exploit or demean. And you've got to keep in mind what's an inside and what's an outside conversation. And we make this product, though it comes from me and our staff and our co-founders, it's for everyone. This is not a product that is just for black folks mm-hmm. at all. Just like any other product that you buy
anything.
Is not just for white folks, even
right.
though they only make it in flesh color and it's pink. But we find a way to adapt and find our way, find a place for ourselves in it. And when we do this, we make sure that there's no coonery, tomfoolery, shucking and jiving in our characters or caricatures, right? We don't have any eye popping. We don't use the N-word. We're not doing things that will degrade folks. Mm-hmm. What I found as an actor, somebody who reads scripts for a living and looks at narrative storytelling, I see that, in particularly in the comedic spaces, people go really far out of their way to hurt others in the process of telling jokes, to mock a group, Indians, Native Americans, women, gays, whoever, often making the least powerful, punching down,
mm-hmm.
frankly, right?
Right.
We don't have to punch down in order to have fun. It's really not necessary. And a Broji is an extension of that philosophy. We're able to make sure that we're not the only ones using it. And if you're going to exploit an Anton Dotson, Sweet Brown or something.
Sweet Brown, yes.
Use it properly and us to just try to prevent ourselves from becoming the butt of our own jokes. We've all watched a show or a comedy bit where we see everybody's laughing, but they're laughing at you, not
mm-hmm.
with you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a tightrope. That's just part of the black experience is you constantly have to be aware of that. It's what Chappelle talks about with why he left.
Right.
When he was on set. And at a certain point, I don't know if you're laughing at us or with us. I need to go clear my head on this.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things you mentioned when you were talking about this, can they use it against me or to mock our culture?
Mm-hmm. Like,
that's the big question.
Yeah. This is one of the added burdens of, being one of the many of being, of color and particularly black. In this country, is everything is a triple-edged sword. Is it help me get in, or is it also going to help quickly get me extracted from this scenario? And we want to make sure that we're able to celebrate our, and we're an incredibly creative demographic. It just is true. And we're cranking out a lot of content, a lot of ways to express our feelings and thought processes and experiences. And we can communicate with a head nod.
Mm-hmm.
The slightest head nod, the slightest affectation tells you a story.
Yep.
It tells you a story. If you see two black men walking on the street and we give ourselves a head nod when we walk by and we don't know each other, we've all had that person. Do you know him? Nah. But we know, but there is something else that we do know.
Right.
That we've all experienced. And that's deep. You can't, what category do you put that in?
You can. That's, I mean, Black-ish did a whole episode on the nod.
Yeah.
And it was when I was with, on a trip to Rome almost 10 years ago. And a friend who lived in Paris at the time met me in Rome.
Yeah.
And we're walking around. It's at nighttime. We're leaving from dinner. And there are all these African Americans that you just sort of run into. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're taught you better speak, especially when you, or at least acknowledge.
Yeah.
And so walking along, and I would nod, and they would nod. And finally, my friend Brian said, do you know
everyone?
Do you know them? Do you know all the, you're nodding to everybody. I said, I can't explain it. It's the code.
Yeah, it's the code. It's acknowledging. I think it's a little bit of like a survivor and survival mechanism. Mm-hmm. And we've all been through it. I see you.
I got you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Those are both two categories. We have an I see you category and an I got you category.
All right. So speaking of categories, is Sweet Brown in there? Because I use
sure
Ain't Nobody
is.
Got Time for That.
Ain't Nobody Got Time for That. Lord Jesus, it's a fire.
So for people who don't know, one of the reasons why you are so passionate about African-American culture and African-American history is that you graduated from Temple with a double major, African-American Studies and Media Arts.
Yes, that's right. Film, Media Arts.
Film, Media Arts. So you're not sort of the way people stereotypically think of Hollywood people who just popping off to talk about stuff with no context, no history. You are deep in the. You studied this. You live it. You studied it. You care about it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is who I am. I was a student. You know, first of all, you know, I lived a black experience in this country. I'm a student. I've also lived a very privileged mixed race, light skinned, blue eyed, freckled experience. I've got a huge white family. I'm white. I'm black. That stuff informs the
You're
walk.
Swedish
my walk
and American.
Of life. Yeah. And I'm also male. I'm also straight. I'm also all these things that inform me. And then you go into my parents are both, you know, socially conscious and active. And I, in college, I studied those things and I taught in high schools and was an activist and organizer in Philadelphia. And all these things, you know, plug into the who and the what and the why you live and what your mission is and things that you care about. So that informs the choices I make as an actor, as somebody who's politically active. And, you know, I'm perpetually a student. I'm learning. But these are things that I wouldn't put myself at the risk that I do. None of this stuff helps my career in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. So why would I be doing it if it wasn't something that meant a lot to me?
How did you go from being, because your first job out of college was high school teacher?
Yeah.
How did you go from there in Philadelphia?
Yeah.
To now being, was it Dr. Jackson Avery?
Yeah, it was
on Grey's Anatomy.
I had in the summers in Philly, I lived at my friend's place in East Flatbush in Brooklyn. So that was my kind of intro to New York, was coming to New York. And New York is so close to Philly, I would hop that Chinatown bus. A $12 round trip Chinatown bus. Sometimes it would catch on fire. Sometimes it would get raided by the police. But otherwise, it's an inexpensive way to move. And so I would go to New York a lot. I was fascinated by New York. I knew I didn't want to go there for college because I would likely drop out. It would be too distracting. But I was in and out of New York, and I was kind of scouted by an agent to maybe do commercials and some modeling on the side if I had time to get to New York. I did a little bit of that. That kind of introduced me to that culture a little bit. I booked a couple commercials. And then fast forward, once I graduated college and continued to teach and then came to New York and dabbled in, I worked law firms for a year and a half on high level second request hostile takeover cases. I worked as a bartender and a bar back and a busboy.
Soho Grand Hotel, I believe.
Soho Grand Hotel. I waited tables. Terrific experience there. then I called up that old commercial agent that I had and said, you know what? I'm having a bit of a quarter-life crisis, don't quite know what I'm going to do, but I really enjoyed a couple of the experiences I had acting. He had sent me on a couple things. I almost booked a couple films and a TV show and got a contract offer on a TV show once that I turned down. to finish school. I liked that it was an extension of my film. To answer your question, I was making films as a film major.
Okay.
And I loved the storytelling process. And I learned later in life that that acting is part of that storytelling process. I did not consider that to be part of it. I thought about producing, writing, the composition of the frame, things like that. But the actor, you'll get an actor and they'll say the words.
Mm-hmm.
And as I started to do that more and more, I realized, oh, I'm actually participating in this. And I really grew to like it. And I took a shot and got lucky and started off Broadway doing an Edward Albee play and kind of took it from there. I'm still winging it.
Incredible. And in the process, you know, being a part of an incredible show like Grey's Anatomy.
Yeah, being what a privilege. Incredible show.
Being Shonda. Voted, oh my God, sexy. Wait, you like several distinctions here. I knew that there was a sexiest man alive. I didn't know that there was sexy man of the week. You got that too?
Well, it was a slow week. It was a slow week. It was in February, so it was kind of like a six-day week, you know, as a holiday. Most people were out of town.
Does it make your head spin? You see these things, you're like, come on, man. Is this really what my life is?
I do my best. Yeah, it is bizarre. It is surreal. And I think that, you know, when you are, when you try to be an active thinking person connected to the universe and you, sometimes I feel misrepresented by things that are about optics and aesthetics and the beauty standards that somehow determine that I am attractive. Those things don't represent me. I have nothing to do with them. I didn't earn them. I didn't beat somebody in a competition to get light eyes. And we happen to prioritize light eyes in this society. That doesn't represent me. It's got nothing to do with me. It's just the way I look. So I don't take credit for it. And sometimes, it makes me feel uncomfortable. But it also helps provide a platform. So the least I could do is try to use that platform. That's how I view it.
So we started this conversation talking about your BET acceptance speech. And at another BET taping that BET did to celebrate the tenure of mm-hmm. President Obama, the Love and Happiness concert that they did on the South Lawn of the White House that happened a few days after the Italian state dinner, the president's last state dinner as president. We were both there. You were actually a part of the show,
mm-hmm.
and you walked out and you said, the first words out of your mouth were, "And another thing."
Yeah, I wasn't sure if that was going to play. That was my first time appearing on TV and on BT since the speech. I thought I would come out and pretend it was going to be a continuation of that. And it got a great response. People got the joke. Chappelle in particular gave me, just loved it. It was like great comedic timing, just loved the whole thing. So I got approved by the greatest one alive. So that was cool.
And so I bring that up because forget about talking about the actual Love and Happiness thing.
Yeah.
To me, the most incredible moment was the after party.
Yeah, it was epic. It was really something special. The East Room, East Wing of the White House, it was very black. And we're DJ D Nice on the wheels and playing really great music. It's populated with people so full of joy. It was really, wouldn't you say, Jonathan, something that was like really joyful, but also kind of, it was a little bit of a mourn. It was kind of like a funeral celebration because we kind of know that it's ending.
Right.
So you feel sad. It's the end of an era, but it's a point of rejoicing. And something else that stuck out to me in that room with all these folks of color, particularly black folks, dancing to our music and celebrating our culture and celebrating this great president, really the people, forget the title, but the people mm-hmm. and the sacrifice they make and what they represent to us. But you're also in a room, keep in mind, surrounded with these grand paintings of slave owners and just old men of note, white men of note at the
former
time that
presidents.
All would have and, you know, have committed and were part of, you know, the way I view these things, I'm always going to be Debbie Downer, view these things as, you know, they were slave owners that oversaw atrocities of our people. And they're all stuck to the wall having to witness this new age. And for me, that juxtaposition was really surreal.
In that room, in the East Room of the White House, is a huge, beautiful portrait of President George Washington,
mm-hmm.
who is standing in profile looking down. And what he's looking at is an East Room packed with African-Americans who are in this incredibly
euphoric
joyous,
state.
Euphoric
yeah.
state, dancing, the DJ saying, here's another song you never thought you would hear
right.
in the White House. And then the floor would explode. My mother, I took my mother, then 74 years old, and we ate a little something, and I thought, let's go into the East Room, and because there's a DJ there, let's just go see. And my mom looks, and there's a song that she likes, so she goes on the dance floor, and I figured, okay, she'll dance for a little bit. I'll hold her bag, and I'll hold this and that, and I'll stand off to the side. An hour later,
74 years old.
Miss Lady comes off that dance floor, and she goes, ooh, okay, I'm ready to go. Now, meanwhile, I've looked off to the right, and I see a tall black woman, thin, in blue sequins and long hair. And I said, you know what? There's only one person in the world who that looks like.
Hmm.
That ain't Naomi Campbell.
Yeah.
And she turned around, and it was like, oh, my God, it's Naomi Campbell. Am I in an episode of Empire?
Empire,
holy smokes.
Yeah.
But then the best part was my mom comes off the dance floor. And she had already kicked off her shoes.
Of course.
So she was about to putting her shoes back on. I was holding her, putting her shoes back on, and then jamming came on.
Oh, yeah.
And she kicked those shoes off and went right back to the dance floor. And then I was like, well, shoot, this is the safest place on the planet. I'll put your purse right down here. And I went out and danced with her. And then all of a sudden, it was as if, and you were, I don't know if you were in the East Room or you were up in the residence with the president, but all of a sudden, everything in the room changed, and people were screaming because the president and, I guess, Usher and Janelle Monáe
and Michelle, just the president,
came into the East
Room. Doors opened, like Heaven's Gate.
And folks lost their minds.
Yeah.
Where were you at that moment?
I was on stage with, I think, Chappelle and D-Nice, so I had a good vantage point looking right down at it. Those doors opened just to my left. The light cast in to this kind of dark dance floor room, and we're celebrating him and them and the administration. Everybody's so happy, and then he actually graced us with his presence and joined the center of the dance floor. It was just the icing on the icing on the icing on the cake. It was really, really a game changer. And it became this, like, almost, what do you call it? Everybody circled on the center. Everything moved into this mosh pit of joy. And I love what you said. You realize this is the safest place on the planet. And that's what it felt like. It was safe for us to be us and to express ourselves and be happy and celebrate him and what this whole administration meant. It was just pure. It felt like a real kind of pure experience for folks to not have to feel any kind of cringe or apology or lack of safety. It was really a blissful moment.
Jesse Williams, co-founder of Ebroji, actor who plays Dr. Jackson Avery on Grey's Anatomy. Thank you so very much for coming on the podcast.
I appreciate it. This has been a joy. It's been a pleasure. Thank you guys for listening. Appreciate it. Download Ebroji. It's free on all devices.
Thanks for listening to Cape Up. Tune in every Tuesday. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. And how about doing me a huge favor? Subscribe, rate, and review us. I'm Jonathan Capehart of The Washington Post. You can find me on Twitter at CapehartJ.
If you like Cape Up with Jonathan Capehart, you should check out some of our other great podcasts, like Can He Do That? With Allison Michaels, a podcast that explores the powers and limitations of the American presidency. Or try Other, Mixed Race in America, a mini-series of stories to make you think about race, identity, and what it means to be an American. You can find these shows anywhere you listen to podcasts and learn more online at washingtonpost.com/podcasts.
The Washington Post.